This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 12th of September 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from 2012 World Design Capital Helsinki, with me, Andrew Tuck, and Marcus Hippy.
On today's programme, we'll meet the mayor of Helsinki, Jussi Pajunen, and find out how the city is renewing itself through design.
We'll also ask the editor-in-chief of Finland's largest business weekly about the country's economic future in the wake of Nokia's slumping share price, and try and find out where Finland will find the innovators to reboot the economy.
Plus, we'll talk fashion with the CEO of Finnish clothing and textile giant Marimekko.
All that and some food sampling with one of Finland's top chefs right here on Monocle 24, live from Helsinki.
And now the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
A Libyan interior minister has today blamed poor security at the American consulate in Libya's second biggest city, Benghazi, for the death of the US ambassador, Christopher Stevens, and three embassy staff. Wanis al-Sharif said the Americans should have taken extra security measures when the protests erupted outside. The Libyan leader, Mohamed Magharif, has apologized to the United States over the attack. Militiamen targeted the ambassador's car in a protest over a US-produced film that's said to insult the Prophet Muhammad. Well, the U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton expressed her outrage over the incident.
This is an attack that should shock the conscience of people of all faiths around the world. We condemn in the strongest terms this senseless act of violence, and we send our prayers to the families, friends, and colleagues of those we've lost.
Meanwhile, the Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has asked his embassy in Washington to take legal action in the United States against the makers of the film. The Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti has welcomed today's ruling by Germany's Constitutional Court, which clears the way for the adoption of the European Union bailout fund. Speaking at the same news conference, the World Trade Organization chief Pascal Lamy said the WTO now expects global trade this year to grow less than it forecast 6 months ago. Here, the British Prime Minister David Cameron has said today that he was profoundly sorry for failures and cover-ups in the wake of the 1989 Hillsborough soccer disaster, in which 96 spectators died after a crowd crush in the stadium. He was speaking in Parliament as an independent report found that police at the time deflected the blame for Britain's worst sporting disaster onto Liverpool soccer fans to cover up their own flawed response.
With the weight of the new evidence in this report, it is right for me today, as Prime Minister, to make a proper apology to the families of the 96 for all they have suffered over the past 23 years. Indeed, the new evidence that we're presented with today makes clear, in my view, that these families have suffered a double injustice. The injustice of the appalling events, the failure of the state to protect their loved ones, and the indefensible wait to get to the truth, and then the injustice of the denigration of the deceased, that they were somehow at fault for their own deaths. So on behalf of the government, and indeed our country, I am profoundly sorry that this double injustice has been left uncorrected for so long.
The Canadian Foreign Minister, John Baird, on a visit to India, has said that India could greatly benefit from Canada's huge reserves of oil and natural gases.
So there are great opportunities for oil and gas, for Canada as a stable, liberal democracy and open economy, to provide for India's economic growth and energy security. We also had a very good discussion on security and counterterrorism cooperation. This is an area with which we see great opportunities.
And finally, the next generation iPhone 5, which Apple plans to release this week, may not only boost the technology giant's bottom line, but could also give a significant boost to the US economy. Sales could add between a quarter and a half a percentage point to the quarterly growth figure for the United States. A chief economist estimated that 8 million iPhone 5s will be sold, raising over $3 billion. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
So Thank you very much, Jonathan, for the news. It's 2:05 in Tokyo, 18:05 hours in London, and 10:05 a.m. in Los Angeles. And indeed, you're listening to Midori House live from Helsinki.
Well, Marcus, you're back in your home territory, and I see you have a giant pile of the local newspapers sitting in front of you. What has caught your eye now you're back on your home turf?
A very quick glance. I noticed that when it comes to the papers, when it comes to discussion topics, they don't seem to change that much. Iltalehti is one of the papers. It's slightly tabloidy, though. But anyway, the big discussion topic is, or like the big news on the front page cover, is how rude Finns are.
And how rude? And this is, Finns are rude to people from other countries, or?
No, in this case, Finns have been rude to ex-president couple of this country.
And what have they said?
Well, you know, this old couple in their 80s got into a tram, and no one gave them a place, a seat.
Despite being the former president?
Yeah, I don't know if anyone recognised.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if you've noticed that, but.
I'm not sure. I've always thought he was quite polite, Marcus.
I am trying to be polite. I think Finns are polite, but I think Finns are quite often misunderstood due to language reasons as well. Did you know that Finnish language doesn't have word for please?
So how do you get what you want?
You say that you want it.
And oddly, you get it, do you?
Quite often.
Okay. All right, Marcus. That's another story, I think. But so we've had one tabloid story. Is there anything else that's caught your eye? I must say, yesterday when we arrived, you were very excited to see all the tabloids. Because you claim that they're actually not on the internet.
They are on the internet partly, but not. Quite often you can't read the whole stories.
Okay.
You know, that's the media logic, you know. But another thing that I spotted today, I've actually mentioned it already earlier today on Monocle 24, is the discussion on conscription, military service. That's been, well, you know, all the Finns, all the Finnish males basically have to do military service or civil service unless they've got special reasons why not to, such as health. And now a quite high-ranked military official has been wondering where this country gets money for its defence. And what is interesting is that he actually mentioned that it may be that in the future this country has to think again about this conscription.
Now, traditionally, that's been something you've kept just because of the kind of huge long border with Russia and this kind of uneasy relation in the East. But as that begins to settle down, is the feeling that actually perhaps you don't need conscription then?
It's a very complicated question because in this country still so many people believe in that. People believe in defence, people believe in conscription. So when you go and ask people, quite often they say that we should still have it.
Well, we're going to have more interesting guests than you in this show. So I'm going to stop you there.
Andrew, can I ask you for a favour?
I want you to do something. A drink or something?
No, I want you to do something during the following 60 minutes.
What's that?
I want you to give an example of your Finnish accent you've learned during this trip.
Okay, I'm not sure that I'll do that in front of our first guest anyway, but we'll find out later because you're listening to a very special edition of Midori House that's coming to you live from Helsinki.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Dette Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det her Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And it's just coming up to 9 minutes past the top of the hour, and you're listening to this special edition of Midori House, coming to you live from Finnish Broadcasting Company studios in Helsinki.
Helsinki is in the midst of a vast makeover with new neighbourhoods being built and the docks relocated. But not everything has gone City Hall's way. Plans to open an outpost of the Guggenheim had to be abandoned in the face of local opposition. And to tell us where the city is heading and how it can capitalise on its status as design capital, we are joined by the mayor of Helsinki, Jussi Pajunen. Welcome to Midori House.
Thank you.
Indeed, Helsinki is the World Design Capital 2012. It's been 9 months now. How has this time changed this Finnish capital?
I would say that the first 9 months of the capitalship year, it has been a success in a very many different ways. But what I like most is that the people have understood the meaning of design and the meaning of how we do things together.
And as a mayor, when you see that you've won this accolade or this position to be the design capital, are you happy because you think it'll bring in more tourists or that it will help, you know, reinvigorate your business community? or is it something for the homegrown audience? What was it that made you think that it was a good idea to try and win this title?
I would say that the number one thing is doing things together. The second thing is it's not an Olympics we are organizing. It's a kind of a journey for the all of us. Journey which the basis of which is our fine design tradition, the history of design. And then the enlarged concept of design that, for example, talking about the city of Helsinki, what is most important for me is the design of welfare services. What is the future of the welfare services, how we are able to keep it and make it even better. And then one thing, of course, is how to get the ordinary people together, work for the design. And that is something which has happened. People know about it, and there are a lot of different projects from whatever.
What kind of examples can you give about these kind of small projects?
One thing which is very much, very, very often mentioned is, of course, the pop-up restaurants, which we have the restaurant days, and people are cooking for people passing by, and then of course we have expositions, we have different things to do. Of course, universities are very, very close to the center of the project with the design factories, and of course we have the traditional industry and design, which is the, in a way, the core of the year. But most interesting is to get people together. Now we have an excellent exhibition in our ex-gas factory design from all around the world.
Now, can I ask you, one of the things that's made Helsinki stay in the headlines over the last few years has been these extraordinary number of urban projects you've got going on, the rebuilding of the Docklands, rebuilding all the suburbs. I went to a conference this morning that's looking at the suburbs around Helsinki and all the things that you're doing to develop those up in Vantaa, the idea of having an aerotropolis up there. That's great, but like most countries around the world, Finland is facing some kind of tougher economic times. Do you think you can carry on with this pace of change? And do you think that all of these projects are going to be seen through to fruition?
I feel that the design years, in a way, it's going contrary to the financial crisis and everything. It's a kind of a good message to the people. Of course, we are tackling with the financial crisis and in the effects of it. But to have something which is actually design years is very close to the business world also. We have an excellent business partner working with us. And doing together, thinking about the future. And one thing which you mentioned already about Helsinki, which is excellent. We have very fine dynamics in our society. New projects and very talented young people, especially with the cultural education coming to the market.
What do you think, how is Finland, Helsinki going to cope in the future in this global competition when Helsinki is not only competing against its major city neighbors such as St. Petersburg, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Oslo, but also, you know, with China, Asia and so on? How have you thought about the future?
Of course, we have to be realistic. The population of the metropolitan area in Helsinki is 1 million people. We are not in the same league as the world's largest cities. But the dynamism here around the Baltic Sea region and what is happening here, very many of the things happening, and they are happening in Helsinki or in the nearby of Helsinki. The location of Helsinki, only 70 kilometers from Tallinn, 7.5 million passengers between the two cities. In a way, we are a twin city with Tallinn, and 3.5 hours by train to St. Petersburg. It's something which it didn't exist 25 years ago.
I wanted to ask you about that relationship, especially with Russia. Is that something that you're seeing, you know, bring fruition in bringing more money into Helsinki?
I think if you want to have a successful city, our concept is that it is, we want to be fun and functional. But one thing is that you need the ingredients of a success. And the success is that it must be, you must have a growing economy. You must have talented, well-educated people. And one of the best industries today, for example, is tourism in Helsinki. It has the best growth rates.
And where do the biggest numbers of people come from? Who's your biggest number of visitors from? I presume in the Nordic region, but then where else are the big numbers of visitors coming to Helsinki from?
It's very balanced for the origin of the tourists, but let's say the best, the largest growth figures today come from tourists from Russia and from China and from the East. They are the best growth, but it's very balanced. We have a lot of cruising passengers from United States, from the Southern Europe. So it's in a way, Helsinki today is very multicultural, also with the tourists.
Last, I need to ask about how Helsinki caters, you know, those big tourist groups, say from Russia and from China. What does Helsinki offer to them? How are you going to attract even more bigger numbers of these tourists to Finland?
I'd say that the number one thing is that we are fun and functional. It's fun to be in Helsinki, but everything is in order, and then you can rely that the bus is coming at time, and everything is functioning. And it's then of course we have the nature, and Finland and Helsinki is a bit different from the rest of the Europe.
Thank you very much for this. That was Mayor of Helsinki Jussi Pajunen.
Thank you, and welcome to Helsinki.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. You are listening to the Midori House live from Helsinki. We'll be talking business with Reijo Ruokanen, the editor-in-chief of Finland's largest business weekly, Talouselämä, after this.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new program on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This she makes me wanna dance. Is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Helsinki, with me, Andrew Tuck, and Marcus Hippie.
For the past decade, Finland's economy has avoided most of the problems facing its cash-strapped neighbours in the Eurozone. But with one of its biggest employers, Nokia, in dire straits, many have started to question whether the good times will last. Just yesterday, Sampo Bank predicted that Finland would experience zero growth over the next year.
Now, to talk us through the condition of Finland's once enviable economy, we're joined by Reijo Ruokanen, the editor-in-chief. I know you're probably looking me across the table, I think, already at murdering his name there. The editor-in-chief of Finland's largest business weekly. Hello, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Is that a good approximation of your name?
You did quite okay with my name and the weekly. It, not only biggest in Finland, but biggest in all Nordic countries, and it's called Talouselämä.
Talouselämä. Okay, we're there.
You're there.
Good.
I think Andrew did quite well.
Thank you. I'm going to be judged after this, I can see, by Mr. Hippie. Let's start, first of all, with Nokia. You know, it's an extraordinary story of a company that 10 years ago was being credited with being the absolute engine of this economy. Now, as it faces bigger and bigger problems, what is that doing to Finland? Is it forcing Finland to invest in other industries? And is it really still today, if it goes any further down, does it have the potential to threaten the future of Finland?
It is forcing us to think again. Yes, but that's nothing new for us. You have to remember that we used to be relying on forest industry for about 3, 4, 5 decades. And then obviously that came to an end, well, not to an end, but these things changed. Unfortunately, people don't read magazines on paper so much anymore. So we are losing business there. We had to rethink it in those days. Then came Nokia. It used to employ about 25, 30,000 people in Finland, which is not really that much. But the whole sector, the whole process was about maybe 100,000 people. But it did bring us a lot of money. Now we have to rethink again. That's nothing new to us. It is a, it's another twist in the story, but we have to get through it.
You sound very positive. What next? I feel like when I follow the Finnish media, everyone is messing on about Angry Birds. But Angry Birds is not going to hire another 30,000 people, is it?
No, absolutely not. Rovio, the company behind Angry Birds, they used to have 12 employees 3 years ago. Now they have 600. They might grow up to 6,000, but it's not going to be like, it's never going to be like Nokia was. But the game industry will employ maybe one day, maybe 20, 30,000 people in Finland. I think our biggest new hope is in clean tech. Finnish companies in clean tech have been pretty smart, innovative, and creating new products. And cleanliness, being clean, cleaning the environment, is the big hit in the society. It's gonna be big in Asia as well. And we are rather good in that business.
And can I ask you, the people who have been working for the likes of Nokia, even if they lose their jobs there, is this seen as a positive in a way for the economy, in that you have this big workforce of very technically minded, skilled people who can do lots of other things, obviously, than just make mobile phones? Are these the people who can, you know, steer Finland off in a new direction?
That is one way of thinking it, and that's the way how we should think about it. Rather than think that we got all these people losing their jobs, we have a lot of potential out there in the market, good people with good ideas who can make big things to happen. And funny enough, the unemployment rate of civil engineers in Finland today is lower than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. So basically, these people are finding new jobs. They come from a fantastic company with great ideas, and they are creating new companies. I think the issue that we have to kind of get grips with is that Nokia is not going to be replaced by one big company. Rather, we're going to have 1,000 small companies doing the business.
And could you also tell me, when you look at the outside of Finland, you see a country that's not quite sure some days about whether it really wants to be part of this giant Euro project or not. What do you think is the feeling now in government? Do you feel that people, you see stories that, you know, the Finnish don't want to kind of, you know, back the Greeks or back the Italians, that they feel that they are being kind of dragged into somebody else's messy business. What is the feeling really about the Euro now in Finland?
Well, you could say it's kind of a polarized. Yes, we tend to make noise about we don't want to pay anyone else's bills or pay for their mistakes. At the same time, we all do understand that Euro for us has been part of our success story. We don't have to worry about the currency exchange rates changes so much nowadays, and it used to be a huge risk for our business. But the biggest thing there behind it is that for us, Euro and the whole EU thing is not about business, it's about security. The closer we are to the, say, nucleus of Western Europe, the more safe we are. I mean, it's always a question about foreign policies against our big eastern neighbor. And that's why we all do, deep in our hearts, understand that the more we do cooperate with, say, Central Europe, the more safe we are. We can't rely on ourselves when it comes to the defense, and we are not a part of NATO. So it's far, far better for us to be part of a growing strong Europe.
Talking about the eastern neighbor, Russia, on the other hand, what does the future look like with that country? Do you think there's going to be more business connections over there? Do you think there could be more money flowing into Finland from that direction?
Absolutely. There is. Russia is a country with huge natural resources and lots of money. And we have a tradition of making business with them. It's kind of a love-hate-fear relationship. And we, I think the hate is gone. There is love and kind of a, I don't know, feeling. But yes, we are making more and more business with them. Russia is still a difficult business partner, but we've been doing business with them for decades, and it's easier now that it's kind of a, so should I say, capitalistic country, and there's lots of money, lots of business opportunities for Finns there.
And we did see over the last few years, you know, some high profile cases of Finnish companies going into Russia and trying to set up business and actually finding it very difficult to compete in Russia on Russian terms. Are you thinking it is more of a one-way direction, people, Russians investing here rather than Finns going the other way and opening department stores in Moscow or St. Petersburg or Ekaterinburg?
I think it's going to be two. It's going to be both ways. It's not going to be one way. Yes, we've had some problems there, but far less than some others. All the big energy companies, excluding the Finns, have been escaping from Russia because they thought it's the you can do the business the same way that you do business in Germany or in the UK. Well, you can't. Russia is a different story, and I think we do have a lot to bring there and export there, and we do it quite successfully already.
Well, thank you very much, Reijo. That's Reijo, who's the editor. Now, let me see if I can do this without you telling me off again. He's the editor-in-chief of Talousele Lama. Almost?
Reijo, what do you think?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to...
I would give it B+.
B+. B+ is a good start. Well, you're listening to a special Midori House broadcast live from Helsinki, and it's 3:27 a.m. in Sydney, 20:27 here in Helsinki, 18:27 in London, and 12:27 in Mexico City.
During the next half hour on, we get a taste of Finnish cuisine. French President Jacques Chirac once said that there is only one country with worse food than Britain, and that country is Finland. We prove him wrong. We also speak Finnish fashion with the CEO of Marimekko, the legendary textile company, and talk Finnish design with the head of Helsinki World Design Capital 2012 project, Pekka Timonen. Before the news at the bottom of the hour, this is Architecture in Helsinki with Escape.
Now, very soon, we're going to explore the evolution of the Finnish textile and fashion industry with the CEO of Marimekko. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. A Libyan interior minister has today blamed poor security at the American consulate in Libya's second biggest city, Benghazi, for the death of the US ambassador, Christopher Stevens, and three embassy staff. Wanis al-Sharif said the Americans should have taken extra security measures when the protests erupted outside. The Italian Prime Minister Mario Monti has welcomed today's ruling by Germany's Constitutional Court, which clears the way for the adoption of the European Union bailout fund. At the same news conference, the World Trade Organization has announced that global trade this year will grow less than it forecast 6 months ago. Here in London, the British Prime Minister David Cameron has said today that he was profoundly sorry for failures and cover-ups in the wake of the 1989 Hillsborough soccer disaster, in which 96 spectators died after a crowd crush in the stadium. An independent report found the police at the time deflected the blame for Britain's worst sporting disaster onto Liverpool soccer fans to cover up their own flawed response. And the Canadian Foreign Minister, John Baird, on a visit to India, has said that India could greatly benefit from Canada's huge reserves of oil and natural gas. I'll have more news at the top of the hour.
Since the 1950s, Marimekko has been known for its big, bright textile prints for furnishings and fashion. But don't imagine that this is a company from a genteel yesteryear. The company is pushing into China and already has over 20 stores in Japan, and it's just staged a catwalk show at New York Fashion Week.
This year, for the first time, it will make more of its money outside of the country than in it. But the business is still finding that profits can be elusive. And to tell us more, we are joined by Mika Ihamuotila, chairman and CEO since 2008. Welcome to Midori House, Mika.
Thank you very much.
Let's start from one of the papers I had here on the table. This is Iltalehti, and there's actually two pages with big photos on what was going on at New York Fashion Week. It seems that Marimekko was a success.
Yeah, I think so. I just landed to Helsinki a few hours ago, and we had a big show there, and the idea of the show was to show our colors and actually to bring color to this world, which is today very, very gray, and people are very kind of performance oriented, and they are showing to other people that I'm successful and, you know, this and that. And we wanted to bring something totally different to New York Fashion Week, to bring the colors, to bring joy to people, to bring authenticity. And one thing that New York talked about in our fashion show was, for instance, that we brought three legendary models there, one who was 81, one who was 70, one who was 60, and they were there with their evening gowns in bare feet. And it felt really great because we really brought something totally different there, something very Finnish, something very Marimekko-ish, but something that I believe that the world needs today more than ever.
Now, before we talk about the journey that you've taken, Marimekko, and let's just clear up the business side of this. I see that, you know, your profits have gone up and down slightly, and you've said that there will be good profits by the end of the year, but you've just had a trading loss. What do these big swings, what do these big numbers really mean?
Mm. Well, when I started 4 years ago with my new team, we saw that there is a huge potential in Marimekko, that there's an uncapitalized asset, you know, to take it further in the fashion and design world. And 4 years ago, I told to the capital markets that I'm here to support this company as the main owner in a very long term. And I decided then, together with my team, that we're going to expand the company without looking at quarterly results. And during these 4 years, we've been launching a lot of new product categories like glass, ceramics, jewelry, and so on. At the same time, we've been opening, you know, tens of stores annually, despite this euro crisis. And actually, the week I started, 2008, Lehman Brothers collapsed. So the reason for these, you know, periodical losses are actually solely the investments we made to the future, and I'm pretty confident that already later this year it's going to look pretty good.
Can you tell me more about this strategy? It's indeed interesting that Marimekko at the moment has over 90 shops, with over 50 abroad, and you're going to open about 20 more by the end of the year, which is very aggressive. It sounds like a lot of risk taking at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, for a company of our size, I mean, we are still a very small company. For us, it's they are big steps, but somehow I feel that it's relatively easy, in the sense that I believe that the world needs our message and needs our values, and that's why it doesn't really feel pushing at all. It doesn't really feel that we would be investing and expanding. It's very much, there seems to be a great pull in different parts of the world, and it seems to be driven by the values, the change in values that you see actually all around the world.
Now you're pushing into China and Asia. What are you offering them? What is it that they're buying into? Are they buying into a sense of Finnishness? Are they interested in the heritage of the brand, or is it really this shock of color and boldness that they really want?
Well, I mean, If we're talking about China, of course, most of the market is not really interested in Finnish design or Danish design or something like that. What they are interested in is what the brand looks like, what the design looks like, and it's primarily the colors and patterns and the brightness and the joy that we bring to people. But if you're talking about China, I think there is a big change going on. In 5 years, China is going to be the biggest consumer market in the world. And what has happened during the last 5 years, it has been a very polarized market. There has been a market for the luxury brands, and then there have been the discount kind of low-end brands. But during the last 2 years, we've seen that there seems to be demand for Scandinavian design, you know, more authentic brands, and we are trying to kind of tap that part of the market. But I've always said to the market and to our partners in China that we are here for the long term. For the next 10 years, 15 years, and I understand that it's going to take a long time before that market evolves.
But if I turn a product over, will it always say made in Finland?
Maybe half of those products say made in Finland, and half of them are made elsewhere in Europe, in Portugal, Baltics. I mean,
but we won't see you setting up a factory in China for a made in Chinese range of Marimekko just yet.
No, we're not going to do that. And actually, what I think is very important is to kind of keep designers close to production. In that sense, we are a totally different kind of a design and fashion brand than most of the other brands in the world. I just decided to triple our fabric printing capacity in Helsinki just to be able to let our designers work very close to production, because the values have changed. The consumers want to see where are the products made under, you know, what kind of ethical conditions are they produced and so on. But even more so, the most talented fashion and design industrial designers today want to work for brands that have own production.
When you talk about the values, how important is Finnishness for Marimekko? When there's a nation customer going to a Marimekko shop, say in Shanghai, will this person realize that these products are Finnish?
Well, usually actually it goes so that somebody comes to the store and like Hillary Clinton said to us in our factory 4 weeks ago, that Marimekko is like breathing happiness. So actually that's what most of the clients in different parts of the world, that's what they first experience, that it's an injection of positivity, injection of authenticity, injection of something happy. And only after they've had some kind of, you know, some time to understand the brand, then they understand, okay, the inspiration of that brand comes from Finland, from, you know, Finnish nature and so on.
I can ask you, for designers who come to work for you, is there a kind of a difficult job ahead? Because, you know, they come to a company that has an amazing archive of prints, many dating back to the 50s, many are classics, many can be tweaked and brought back into production. What's the balance between kind of sticking with what you've done again and again and again and allowing designers to come in and actually change what you're doing?
It's an excellent question. And we have maybe 30% of our designs are iconic old patterns and prints from 50s, 60s and 70s, and the majority are new. But actually, it's sometimes more difficult to take a company forward with a very strong heritage than to start from scratch. And what I'm kind of, in my position, what I'm trying to do is that I'm trying to let my people and my designers be proud of the heritage, however not be restricted of the heritage. And I think it's like us human beings. We should be proud, unless we are proud and happy about our roots, childhood and so on. We are not really balanced. However, if we are too much kind of enrooted to our grandfather's heritage or something like that, we are not able to renew. So it's a fine balance, and you have to be radical and but at the same time happy about your roots.
Thank you very much, Mika Ihamuotila, CEO and Chairman of Marimekko. We will continue our special Helsinki Midori House with Finnish cuisine straight after this break.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. We explore the people and products, the buildings and businesses, the signs and cities that make life better. Each week we bring to life the relationship we have with the things that we live with.
Actually, one of my favorite objects is my motorcycle. I love going by motorcycle. I have this Royal Enfield, a classic English motorcycle from the 50s, but it's exactly as it was in the 50s. And I love the shape, the sound of the engine. I love really how it fits in my life.
We sit down with a cast of characters and chew through the issues at stake in the design world today, across manufacturing, craft, fashion, architecture, and graphics.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Salty licorice, meatballs, and plenty of fish. Finnish food is still internationally pretty unknown, and the Copenhagen food revolution with numerous Michelin-star restaurants is still something to look forward to in Helsinki.
Well, what Finnish cuisine in essential is and what delicacies are worth sampling when you get the chance for it? To give his piece of advice, we're now joined by Sasu Laukkonen, chef and founder as a Helsinki restaurant chef and sommelier. Hello and welcome to Midori House program.
Hi, good evening.
Well, you know, I can tell you from experience after having lived in London for a while that every now and then when I bring in my Finnish delicacies that I really love personally, such as salty licorice and, well, vodka-filled chocolate, I get these looks and people just find that so weird. Tell us yourself as a food professional, what is Finnish cuisine all about?
It is... it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, you talked about the Copenhagen food revolution. Actually, what it is all about is roots, yes?
Yes.
Time and place.
Yeah, raw ingredients, I guess.
Time and place, yes. So, actually, I was in a conversation yesterday, and we were talking about this, that there are numerous ways to look at Finnish cuisine, but one of the things is that we have one of the best raw ingredients possible. Like our wild berries, our wild mushrooms, we don't need to do anything. They grow by themselves, yeah? And all you need to do is just go pick them up and start cooking, right? Wild fish, stuff like this, that a lot of the varieties you can get from here and there and everywhere. But then again, we have our specialities. So basically, we kind of try to lay on top of our old, you know, Karjalan paisti, sort of really meaty stews and stuff. And then stuff that come, the influences from Russia. But instead of talking about what Finnish cuisine has been until now, I think we are finally on the rise, meaning really kind of taking impact and because we've always been the kind of people who don't have that much of a cultural identity. You know, we're kind of small, right? We're a bit kind of like going inwards instead of outwards. I think as chefs, we're finally, because of a lot of what's been happening in the other Nordic countries, we're going like, hey, but we have these same stuff, you know, growing everywhere. So why don't we be proud as well, you know? And because of that, we're finally getting there. Making Finnish cuisine.
I'm going to ask you a question, but can I just say that it's not fair for Marcus to set himself up as a defender of Finnish cuisine. He's brought back to London a tin of bear meat.
Oh no!
From duty free, and then everything else he brings back is from duty free. That's where those bonbons filled with vodka come from. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you that? I think what happened for the food revolution in Copenhagen, especially, was that many of those chefs they travelled, they went to work at El Bulli, they found other ways of cooking.
Yeah.
Are Finnish chefs doing that as well? Are you likely when you go to Paris to find actually the guy in the kitchens from Helsinki? Mm. Are they going on the road to find ideas?
Yes. Yes, they are. Actually, I might as well say hello from Denmark. I was just there over the weekend, dining at Noma on Thursday night, having a fabulous lunch at Manfred's on Thursday lunch. After that, I was in a Nordic competition as one of the competitors competing for the title of Nordic Challenge. I didn't come first or second place because they were just so incredibly gifted, the guys, really relying on their produce. But we all got the same system, the same ingredients, and the same chance of going to a farm to pick whatever we wanted to use, from herbs to tomatoes and so forth. Hence the thing I brought some bread for you.
I was just going to say, you've got a couple of things you've brought in.
I recognise these. I see tomatoes and small apples.
It's not very complicated to recognise a tomato, is it?
Yeah, but this is a real Finnish tomato instead of the stuff you get from the stores.
So tell me what makes a real Finnish tomato.
Well, first of all, because I love the Mediterranean for the fact that when these, for example, tomatoes, this is our bread from the restaurant. It's made today, so please. And just because you wanted some crispy feeling,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So get
this
a bite of
lovely.
Bread. There's our
I can
rye
eat some
bread.
Carbohydrate.
Yeah. Rye bread with rosemary and then our sourdough white bread with a crispy crust.
You're baking bread on your premises every single
yes.
day.
Yes, yes. And I have my own sourdough. It's not like from my grandma's and so forth. So I started it by myself.
Sorry, this is me tearing off a piece of bread. Sorry. Yeah.
You're telling about you know, Finns basically creating Finnish food culture. Yeah. Is it, you know, we talked about international influence and all that, but at the same time, I happen to know that you also talk a lot about, you know, local produce and local ingredients. Mm-hmm. So how do you combine these two?
Well, it's really something, I mean, kind of relating to the question before, right?
We do travel. Also, at the moment, I've got a mouthful of bread. So
yeah,
I'm
good.
Sorry about.
Good, good.
I
you have to try the rye bread as well. We have
it's
some
good.
Rosemary in there.
It's very salty. It's good.
Yeah, yeah. Restaurant bread has to.
Okay,
be
I'm back. I'm back.
Good. So, kind of relying on the question as well, just before, because we travel right now, we see a lot of things. You know, we see chefs going like they have their own farms, and this is true, and actually. So do I.
Could
but it's only a garden. So.
Could you tell me a dish that you do, mm-hmm. you think sums up your contemporary take on Finnish food?
Right now, I think...
A tomato and a piece of bread.
Could be. It could be, if it's a Finnish tomato. Actually, I could talk about something that I'm putting on the menu next, which is right underneath the tomato, which we call piha omena. So apples from someone's yard. They have a very specific taste, a very specific acidity and crust and everything. I mean, the crispiness and all. So I had a vision of taking three different kinds of basil grown in the middle of Helsinki in Kapula or Kumpula on a garden that is, it's the project has been in Helsinki for 100 years now. It's called basically a garden for kids. That they could, I mean, they could just learn about how and where the ingredients come from, how they grow, and learn about all that. I have access to the garden, so I've been picking three different kinds of basil, which grow. They're brought as a seed. They grow here right now, and actually in our culture now we're doing tomato and mozzarella as our own kind of thing. You know, we have Finnish mozzarella and so forth. So I kind of gather the basil could be Finnish. So taking the next step is taking what we've had growing on people's yards all, I mean, every year, right? Taking that Finnish grown basil and making a beautiful dessert out of those two.
Sounds amazing. I know you seem to be quite hardcore local ingredient chef. I remember coming to your restaurant, actually, it was about a year ago, and you had this menu. It was called, I think it was called Wild Herb Menu. You had been collecting herbs from your backyard.
Yes, I live in Espoo, so I'm a Helsinki city boy, but because I have a family now and a three-year-old at home, so it was a good mindset to go 15 minutes further towards Espoo, which actually just gave me a beautiful chance. From my balcony, you look down. It's on the first, or basically second floor. It's 2 meters to the first wild herb, so it's really not that hard to be inspired, right?
Have I got time for one more question?
I have one question. I have. Can I ask you this really quickly?
Yeah.
What do you do during the winter?
I was just going to ask the same question.
We do. I have only two seasons. The season when stuff grow and the season when stuff don't grow.
What do you do in the latter case?
Well, I have to use what we have.
But I was just going to ask you.
Root vegetables, a lot of them, and taking different kinds of influences.
So there are two traditions of almost of Finnish cooking. There's this summer food, and then there's this dense, heavy, let's stay indoors and get fat.
Usually heavier, yes.
Okay.
Heavier, yes.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Sasu. You're listening to a special Midori House live from Helsinki. And very soon, we're going to be talking with the director of Helsinki World Design Capital 2012.
This is Monaco 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Esse é Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
En Monaco 24 dagat, ja.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 ja jokso.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The proper jalavat. Monaco 24.
This
Esto es Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 8 minutes to the top of the hour and you are listening to Midori House live from Helsinki. And since we are in Helsinki, we obviously have to talk about design with a very good reason as well. Helsinki is the World Design Capital 2012. And now we are joined by the executive director of this project, Pekka Timonen. Hello and welcome to Midori House.
Hello, thank you.
Well, about 3 months of World Design Capital time year left. How has it changed Helsinki this far?
I think this today is a good example of how it has changed. We are now living in maybe the busiest weeks of the whole year. And only today we had a very interesting discussion on the pavilion, which is still in the city center. We are hosting a meeting of the global meeting of the Design Week. So we have directors from the Design Weeks all over the place, meeting very first time, by the way. And also opening a co-creation workshop at the cable factory. So basically lots of things are going on right now. And yet in the same time, Everyday Discoveries, which is a mini world expo of design up and running in Suvilahti. So kind of on the surface right now, you can see many things. But for me, it's even more important what happens under the surface.
And Pekka, when this comes to an end, what will be your criteria for judging a success?
That's always a good question. What will success look like? I think the success is that we continue. If people start feeling that this was it and saying that now the flags go down, that was our year as the World Design Capital, let's go back to normal, then we haven't succeeded. So if we have been able, first of all, to change the discussion about design, to have more broad understanding, and then people maybe questioning more questions, understanding that there is more than the traditional things in design, and then if the maximum amount of organizations continue the work what they have been doing last year, this year, that's a success. So things change permanently. More and more people and organizations work with design than before. That's a success.
You have also been faced with criticism from people living in Helsinki. Before this year, they expected that this year would change Helsinki more. You know, they expected that they would see more design on the streets of this city. What would you say back to them?
Well, first of all, I'm actually very happy that there is a critical discussion, because about every MP, every important project needs that. So, and we need that too. The other thing is that year is a very short time. If you do some permanent things on the streets, kind of a great designs, you need more time. And that process is ongoing now. For example, I just read today about great news about how the new prototype of the Helsinki tram is doing when its design process is about getting to the final months, and the tram will be there next year, even though it's been discussed and developed during this year. So when we do take the things seriously and understand that important things take time, so I think the right moment to ask whether this was success or not is maybe 3-5 years from here. I know it sounds a bit strange, but that's how it is. Because when you are dedicated that you change something, and you understand that making good design is not an instant job, and then also there are lots of people who are and organizations who are now first time in their history taking design very seriously. So I should be, my message to people that yes, you are right, some things might have been done differently, but the end of the day, what matters is what happens next.
I think we saw actually the testing yesterday, last night, of the new tram. We were out and we saw we thought at first it was a very minimalist tram, but it was just a chassis, I think, being dragged around and being tested on the rails. Can I ask you, the word design, which is a slightly, it's not just about your event, but wherever you go now, this word is used so broadly. Do you feel it delivers to people any sense of what it entails? Because, you know, every hotel is a design hotel. I saw a building the other day in London. It said, you know, more design for less money. I don't even know what design means. And I wonder if when you're delivering an event to a city, that maybe there's a bit of misunderstanding what even design is, because it covers so many things.
I just saw an advertising saying, a dentist advertising, design your smile. And I thought that was a bit funny. But we have actually faced that discussion many times that, you know, when is everything now design? Is it too broad? But I would say traditionally design is defined very narrowly. Pots and cups and nice things and maybe a little bit exclusively expensive things. So if we are now expanding the limits a lot, I think it doesn't make not so big damage. At least here locally in Finland, we should discuss about it. It's a broad issue. There's a lots of things that we should consider with the design, what design can do. In general, I'm more interested, more interesting question that what design is actually what it can do. And I know that this is also a kind of approach, but design is used as a marketing tool quite often, and design is used as the styling issue, you know, design hotels, design holidays, whatever it is. And that's the way how modern world functions. But for me, design is a very systematic, creative, human-centered method, how we approach physical environments, systems and services. And it can be quite easily defined whether this method has been used or not. And my way of saying that is whether are the users, we human beings, taking into account. If not, there is no design. If yes, it might be.
Pekka Timonen, 10 seconds for this answer. During the last remaining months of Helsinki World Design Capital Year, what's the big catch? What's the one thing to check?
The big catch from the I think how we end this year is it's going to be that the new national design program for Finland will be announced, and Finland as a design nation, we hope for that's going to be a very great program.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Pekka Timonen, and sorry for ending you so abruptly. Well, that's all for this special edition of Midori House, produced by Marcus Hippie. Our researcher was Adrian Craddock, and our studio manager in Helsinki was Jonathan Kotila.
At 2200 hours London time, it's turn for the Monocle Daily with Steve Bloomfield and Tamsin Smith, and Andrew and me will be back at the same time tomorrow live from Helsinki. Headlines are next right here on Monocle 24. Thank you from Helsinki.